10:03, we are going to get the party started. Good morning. We call the St. Paul City Council Org Committee to order. We have a full house here right now. From our perspective, it looks like we're sort of right-leaning, but from your perspective, hopefully it looks like we're kind of left-leaning. So, because we are, and I just noticing that we're a little imbalanced. Ms. Prince is out of town. Ms. Yang is on maternity leave. We hope that Ms. Jalali will join us shortly. So this is our group here today. We have two items. Well, there's three items on our agenda. First, we'll get an update from St. Paul Ramsey County on homelessness, on shelter policies, and the work happening. We have a great group of presenters here. I don't know if we'll be hearing from everybody or if some folks are here as a resource if questions arise. We will talk briefly about the truck parking ordinance changes. We will not talk about that. And we're very excited that we will get an the Right Track intern's final reports today. We've had a great, great group of four Right Track interns, and we're putting them on the spot, bringing them up to the podium, having them present and tell us everything they learned in their summer, or at least the highlights. So we're really looking forward to that as well. So I will try to keep our first part of our conversation to about 1 hour so that we have time to hear from our Right Track interns. And if there's things we just don't get to, I'm still going to let our Right Turn interns take the stage at 11 o'clock out of respect for their schedules. They are here for their last few days, so we can do follow-up with the on our other topics as needed. So just give you a kind of a preview of where we're headed. For folks that are new to this chamber or haven't met our newest council member, Russell Ballinger, Russell Ballinger is in the house. Woo! so it's exciting to be working. He got sworn in last week, and so he's still kind of an enigma to all of us. We're excited to work with him, and these types of updates, I think, just help as we walk into our budget season, understanding where our priorities need to be, where our funding streams need to be directed, and so on. So we'll start out with our update from St. Paul and Ramsey County on homelessness, unsheltered policies, and work. We have Maggie Drian, the Executive Director of Heading Home Ramsey County, Andrea Hinderacker from the HEART team, Tara Beard is here from Housing, Jamie Tincher, our Deputy Mayor, Ryan O'Connor here from Ramsey County Manager, and they're staying in their seats right now. Okay. Great. So now we know who is going to be presenting and then who is resources. Welcome. We'll turn it over to you, and thank you so very much for your work and for being here today.
Well, thank you for having us. We really appreciate it. I'm sure it's not every day that those two are referred to as the resources that will help answer questions behind the scenes. So we're excited to be able to provide you with some information. I'm Maggie Drian, and I'm the Executive Director of Heading Home Ramsey.
I'm Andrea Hinderacker, the Coordinator of the Homeless Assistance Response Team through the city.
And I'm Tara Beard, the Housing Director for the Planning and Economic Development Department here at the city.
Awesome. So I will kick us off here with a little bit of background about where we're at with regard to the $6 million that the state provided to the Continuum of Care to support our homeless response needs here in Ramsey County and City of St. Paul. So a little bit of framing, again, since I know there's some new faces here, about what is Heading Home Ramsey, who are we, and how do we work? So we are a collective impact model group that comes together, a bunch of individuals who all care passionately about preventing and ending homelessness in Ramsey County. And so we are working together to create a community where homelessness is rare, brief, and non-recurring, where we eliminate racial disparities and everyone is housed. And this here is just a visual for you of how we see our role in this space and how we try to organize the system and the resources that are available to try to prevent and end homelessness in our community. The continuum of care has a complex structure, which some of your colleagues here know more about than others, but we have a governing board, we have a steering committee, we have work groups that execute that information, and we obviously have ranking committees that support alongside us. So I just wanted to spend a minute here because I think it's important as we think about how decisions are made in the continuum of care. The governing board is really our strategic leadership team and our decision-making body. We are lucky that that is chaired by Deputy Mayor Tincher, and our vice chair is Commissioner Mattis Castillo. You also have Council Member Naker, who sits on that committee as well. And that group really is in the position to be able to help us make guiding decisions about how we leverage the resources of the continuum of care and help to set the direction of where we want to go. When we were developing our strategic plan last year, they had a critical function in endorsing the final direction that we were going that was informed heavily by the work that happens in our steering committee space. So we really lean on them, their expertise, their connections across the community to make sure that we're addressing the full breadth of needs that we know that exist within our continuum of need. On the steering committee, that's really our operational leaders. Those are the folks who know how to implement, who know how to provide guidance to us about where the policies really meet the road. That's chaired by Alan Ostergaard from Radius Health, and the vice chair is Chris Michaels from Catholic Charities. We also have Andrea, who sits on that committee as well. And so we're fortunate to have really informed people who are sitting in that space, helping us make decisions that will ultimately go to that governing board for them to discuss, debate, and then adopt. The way that we actually carry out our work is through our work group model, and anyone in our community is welcome to participate in those. If there are any that are exciting to you, we're always opening the door to more folks who want to be part of shaping that. But that's really where the work happens. So the work groups is an environment where people need to advance the body of work. There's limited staff that support the continuum of care, and so work groups are how we move that forward. And again, it's everybody coming together around these shared ideas and values that help us move that work forward, and we have many of the city staff that are engaged in that space. And then one of the things I'm just going to highlight briefly is our ranking committee. That's a group that's selected by our governing board, and they are the one that actually reviews different RFPs or proposals or funding opportunities as they come to the continuum of care. The reason I'm flagging them is that they're a big part of how we're moving some of the money that the state has given us. And so that group, we're lucky to have Deputy Mayor Tincher and Andrea, who both sit in that space as well, as we make decisions about how to spend the resources of the continuum.
And before you move ahead, I'm just going to say this before the slide passes. You mentioned that folks are invited to work groups, and I'm quite certain that members of this council and or legislative aides would be interested in participating. So if you want to actually extend that invitation to Ms. Howes, we can follow up on it after the meeting. I don't know if there's been a real clear path towards joining and participating in the work group. So I know that there's interest.
Absolutely, and I'd be happy to do that. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. So state funding, this is probably what you're most interested in hearing about today. So as you're aware, the state provided us with $6 million to support the needs of Ramsey County and the City of St. Paul and our continuum of care. And those funds came to Ramsey County with a direction that they would carry out the actions, activities, and needs of the continuum of care identified by our continuum of care. We put forward an RFP process. So when the funds come, given the way that the COC is set up, they sit in Ramsey County for Ramsey County to administer, but the decision-making happens in the continuum of care space, as we've talked a little bit about. The Ramsey County put out a request for proposals process to say, all right, we've got these three needs that we've been talking a lot about up at the legislature, which were around adult shelter, family shelter, and day shelter needs. That's really what the focus of those three asks were, and that's what the state said we really wanted to help with. So our RFP that we put out to the community requested interest for partners who would want to provide those services in our community. And through that process, our ranking committee was able to review those proposals, and they will be moving forward with a handful of really excellent proposals that help us to expand our capacity in those spaces in our community for the next year. We are excited that as a result of that, we were able to move forward with the majority of responses that came in. But what was interesting is that the short timeline that we have on how to spend those funds put us in a position where actually we aren't spending, through the RFP, we're not allocating out all of the $6 million. And so we find ourselves in a position where the continuum of care gets to look really strategically at how to leverage the remaining $1.5 million that are not allocated out through the RFP process, which is a unique experience for us to find ourselves in a place where we have some flexible funding opportunities to really address the full continuum of need. Again, outside that RFP process, though knowing that we are having a focus on advancing those three specific needs that I identified. So a big question that's been coming to us is, what do we do with the funds that are left over? How do we move that $1.5 million that are outside of the RFP process? And so what I've identified for you here are the next steps for those unallocated funds. The ranking committee, who reviewed in depth those proposals that were submitted through the RFP process, they will be providing some recommendations about where there were gaps. So of the responses that we got, are there components that weren't fully addressed? Are there areas we'd like to see more expanded capacity? They'll have the opportunity to articulate that back to the steering committee. Our steering committee then is going to be in a position to sponsor ideas where they can say across our continuum, these are the variety of needs that we have, and we'd like this specific idea or proposal to be considered. And on the 30th of this month, they will actually be ranking or prioritizing those ideas that are submitted into the continuum of care space. As I mentioned, our steering committee isn't actually the decision-making body about how to use these funds. They're simply there to provide guidance and recommendations from their operational leadership role. And so those recommendations will go to our governing board, who are then going to be in a position to discuss, debate, and then ultimately decide how we allocate those additional $1.5 million in funds. An important note here, I think, as people start to think about how can we best leverage and access those $1.5 million, is what can it be used for? So the proposals that will be submitted to the COC really need to be looking at increasing shelter capacity within Ramsey County, and they need to be looking at addressing unsheltered needs within Ramsey County as well. So as the state developed their contract language over to us, those were the two areas that they highlighted as areas that this funding can be leveraged. There are certainly, with all funds, requirements about how we go about spending that or limitations on what our options are. So I think it's important to spend a moment there. The funds cannot be used on capital expenses. They've been very clear about that. And the funding, because of the ARPA funds and the way they come through the state, it is required that all funds be spent by June 30th of 2023. So that's a deadline that we're working backwards from. We don't want to give them a dollar back. We really want to be able to put all of this into the hands of our community and make sure we're supporting our residents who are homeless or at risk of becoming homeless. Additionally, we do have to follow county procurement guidelines, and so there are going to be specific frameworks that we'll offer to the steering committee that articulate, you know, you can only spend X amount. If you're going to do a sole source, this is how we would do that. So there are requirements about how much we can spend outside of an RFP process that we'll have to honor and recognize, since it will be Ramsey County who ultimately executes those contracts. So I think that's the brief update I wanted to provide, and I'll stop there for questions.
All right, Ms. Dinker.
Thanks, Council President. Maggie, did you mention, and I'm sorry if I missed it, where the allocated $4.5 million is going to, what the proposals were and what the needs are going to be met?
Great question, Council Member. I did not at this time because we are in the process of contract negotiations, and therefore not all of that information is public. What I can say is that there were those three components that we mentioned. There's a need around expanding adult shelter capacity, a need around family capacity, shelter capacity, and then day shelter needs. All three of those had responses, and so we will see increased support for all three of those areas, assuming that our contracts are able to move forward.
Are there other questions before we, Mr. Tolbert?
Do you know what our current shelter capacity is?
I do not off the top of my head, but I would say that we are providing a weekly situation report that that we publish, and it documents what we know as far as our shelter capacity in the community every week. So I can make sure, I think that's been getting to a number of your council members, but we can make sure that that gets to your resources so they can be distributed to the full council as well.
And then does that also have how short we are on the shelter?
So the situation report that we publish weekly, what it provides is an update from the continuum of care. No, we have a different one. Yep. So that is included. We are fortunate that we're able to leverage the great information that your HEART team makes available to us. But in addition, it looks countywide. So we're able to tell you the male shelter capacity, the number of vacant beds, the female shelter, adult shelter capacity, the number of vacant beds, and then we look at the family shelter capacity and the number of vacant beds. We then reach out to each of our communities. Each of the cities have an opportunity to provide an input and update to us as well. Obviously, City of St. Paul does an amazing job providing us with significant resources about their unsheltered needs in the community. So we can make sure that that gets circulated to your group every week. It's published on Fridays, and it is the information that partners provide to us. So certainly, we don't have the ability to go back and check all of that every single day, but we trust our partners to be able to give us up-to-date, good quality information, and we've been seeing that that's been really helpful in understanding what is our actual need in the community versus the known unsheltered numbers that exist.
Great. And that is changing all the time.
Absolutely.
Other questions or responses? All right. Thank you.
Thank you. I guess I had one more slide for you. I lied. So the only other thing I think for you all to know is that our execution date for these contracts we anticipate to be October 1st. That means that we need to align with when the state executes that contract and when our county board approves this, as it must go through their process as well. So
I guess I kind of lied, too. I have a question.
I don't know if this is the right time for this, but we had an update from St. Paul Ramsey County Public Health a few weeks ago, and one of the topics that we touched on was the opioid lawsuit and the settlement dollars from that, resulting from that. Will you be working in partnership with Ramsey County, St. Paul Public Health, with those funds and how they connect to our unsheltered issues? I mean, that's a lot. There's even more resources coming our way, and it seems like there's a nexus here.
So I'm happy to have County Manager O'Connor step in. I think the one thing I would say from a continuum of care perspective is that we're very interested in having proposals that come from all of the partners, and that certainly includes Ramsey County as well, as we seek to see how these funds can best be leveraged. But do you have additional?
Do you want to wait until the end for cleanup, or do you want to do it now?
If that makes more sense to wait and have it be cleanup?
Yeah, we can do cleanup for a couple minutes if we have it.
Okay, that's fine.
We'll come back to that.
All right, just didn't want to miss the opportunity, but if it makes sense at the end, we'll tie it up there.
Thank you. All right, now I'll hand it over.
Thank you so much for your time today. Again, I'm Andrea from the Homeless Assistance Response Team, trying to kind of encapsulate where we come from. Is we are really right now at this point about encampment response, but focusing heavy on creative solutions, being very intentional in our engagement, and then relentlessly engaging. So it's important for that to be the main message, not so much as we're trying to clear or remove people out of sight. We really are engaging, and we are trying to find that balance between enforcement and compassion. And so that's the framework that we come from. On this slide, you'll see the weekly heart update that we have been putting together. We are hoping this answers a lot of questions as you get them from folks in your ward or other folks that you talk to. It gives a little bit of that broad stroke of this is the situation right now citywide. The numbers, when people see them for the first time, are pretty shocking. When I see them and I'm following them daily, I can confidently say that nothing has risen more than 20 over probably a month and a half time period. So we've actually reduced our numbers in different areas, but there isn't a flood of encampments growing. There's movement and there's slow and steady improvement in people's personal situations. In this particular update, which we each week we are focusing on, what is the area that is of most attention, not only community-wise around the encampment, but also quality of living for folks who are within the encampment. And so it gives you an idea of where our energies are focused. So if some folks are like, why is this encampment remain? And I know that it's disappeared somehow out of Hamlin Park. It really is about saying, hey, this is a longer process. People don't just disappear. We really are taking our time and intention, and currently this is where we're focused, and we will continue to move throughout our community and try to address each need. We have begun to modify our closing by way of acknowledging that we don't have the single-room occupancy currently, and we don't know if we'll ever have that large of a capacity again. So how do we continue to address the needs of the folks that we're trying to serve with what appears to be a limited capacity of resources? So what's important to acknowledge first and foremost is we started this closing process at Lower Landing, well over 50 individuals, 47 folks actively engaged with us. That was a period of an entire week. Our staff was out from 7 in the morning until 8 p.m. at night, 3 days prior to the official closing, which then lasted from 8 a.m. until about 3 p.m. in the afternoon. We engaged with about 47 individuals. When we look at how that engagement played out and what it taught us, it taught us that a third of those folks had already been in the single room occupancy hotel shelter. So the main message there is that there is no one fix. And so if we want to see that one answer where we can go in and say, there's 10 rooms, there's 10 people, we've got it, we're good, let's close, let's get them in. What we aren't doing is looking at the individual and saying, is this the right time? Is this a successful response? Will you have success with this one response that we see as sort of the fix-all? We learned very quickly that that wasn't the response. With those individuals, housing, it wasn't the right time. They had higher needs, or they timed out because they weren't able to take that next leap into something more stable, and so we need to figure out what that looks like for folks. Over a third of the folks out there had been homeless for longer than a year but did not have a housing assessment completed. A housing assessment is essentially the entryway into our single point of entry for shelter, right? So if you have been homeless for a year or more, you have this housing assessment done, and you're essentially put in this database, which I like to simply call online dating for housing, right? So I need housing, and I have all these needs and barriers. And you have a housing program with an opening, and your requirements match my needs and barriers. You reach out to me, and we make this connection, and the housing that is most appropriate for me has been offered to me. If you do not have a housing assessment done, you never enter that system, and no one knows that you exist. And so housing opportunities are arising that may or may not meet your needs, and you will never know because they don't know you're out there. So over a third of our folks were offered housing assessments, which essentially, for the first time, put them on the map. One gentleman was homeless 15 years and had his first assessment done when we were at Lower Landing. Over a quarter of our folks had no basic supports, no food support, no GA. When we look at our housing opportunities that are open to folks in high-level poverty, you need 203 at a bare minimum, your GA. That's GRH housing, group residential housing. That's how you are considered for anything where you pay a third of your income. That's your income. If you are living in an encampment and you don't have anything, you also don't have the means to survive safely. You have nothing to barter with. You have no resource to protect your belongings with. So you'll hunker down and you'll stay. You won't go to a food shelf. You won't go to a day service. You won't get your government documents. You aren't going to leave your home because you need to protect what you have, and you don't have anything to offer anyone for a return in services, whether it's safety, whether it's food because you can't get your own food, whatever it might be. As we look at the city on a larger scope, when a large number of our unsheltered folks have no food support at a bare minimum, then you have homeless crimes of opportunity. Because there is nothing you can do but ask straight out people for money. There's nothing you can do outside of a food shelf or a food program, and if you have barriers to utilize any of that, your last option is to steal, or your last option is to harass. You are put in a position where all you can do is ask because you have nothing. Criminal history and active warrants were definitely a barrier that we found at Lower Landing. If you have an active warrant, you cannot get any county benefits. So you no longer have food support, you no longer have GA. So your opportunities for getting out of your situation are gone. If you have fear of the criminal justice system because that has been your life, you will likely not turn yourself in for a warrant. One gentleman that I am working with currently, he had a warrant in Wright County. And while we spent those 3 days working together, I found his parole officer, I found his bail bondsman, and I found his public defender. And we all were in communication to figure out how we can encourage him to turn himself in. He would have been almost guaranteed time served. But then the barrier is, how does a gentleman who has no phone and no transportation get to Wright County to turn himself in? And how does he get back? And the fear that you finally get there and you actually don't get time served is huge. So the better option for this gentleman was to hunker down, to stay off the radar, and to remain camping in the community. The good news is that after we did all of our groundwork, I bumped into him now at the encampment we're closing now, and he received word that his warrant has been lifted. There is nothing now. And so now he's in the process of getting his benefits, and we're working on where he can go next, and his fear level has decreased. So that was 3 solid days, 12-hour days of communicating back and forth when I could catch him to figure out how we can keep following up. There are almost no phones. They're currency for folks. If you need something, they are stolen almost immediately. So if you have any support system, you have almost no way of contacting them or being contacted. So if you were having a housing assessment and you had a housing opportunity come up, you get X amount of days to return the call to say, yep, I want that housing opportunity. And if you don't, it moves on to the next person. That shows that in the number of Section 8 vouchers that had expired. Many folks out there said, I had a Section 8 voucher. I don't know what happened to it. I don't know if I still have it. Can I apply for an extension? They had housing at their fingertips, and they could not access it. Available transportation, when one person moves into a space and builds their entire life within and around their tent, to say, hey, Thursday, we're closing, you need to go. One person has to figure out how to pack all of that up and figure it out and where to go with it. So we acknowledged right away that that is too much for one person. It's already a crisis situation. So the city, we offer transportation. We offer storage, 90-day storage that can be extended. So if you don't exactly know what your next step is, we want to at least reduce that stress of where are my things? Can I get them back? How are we going to figure this out? And then just we learned that engagement requires this level of consistency in showing up. Day after day saying, I'm going to be here tomorrow. If you have maxed out and I've irritated you too much, I've asked you too many questions, I'll be back here tomorrow. Let's try this again. Every person that we engaged with, it was a puzzle. It was just piecework throughout the days so that come Thursday, we had solutions in place. It's important to articulate that we're doing this differently, and it's important to really articulate what we think is success is not always the look of success. We aren't just scooping up people and they're not just disappearing. When we had the county shelters available to us, there was people call me all the time. You know, last year during COVID, we called, we complained, and everyone was gone the next day. The optics look different. And it takes engagement. Just over the course of time closing the encampment at Newell Park, I felt a little bit like a neighborhood therapist, which I actually think is a valid position. In just talking to people and teaching people what the process looks like, what it feels like, the difficulties that can be there, but also empathizing with a neighbor who's trying to figure out what do I do? I feel this way. This is what it looks like to me. This is what I'm experiencing. And I have yet to hang up with someone and not have them be at a level 3 when they called it a 10, right? Like, we've had a conversation, and I always ask for patience. And so sometimes the success is just we're communicating. All of us are communicating. And communication and clarity is kindness on every level. Sometimes we just learn someone's name, and that's it. And they are never going to talk to us in that moment when we're at that site. But if we move and we find them again, then we can call them by name. Knowing someone's name and calling them by name is the highest level of respect. If they've shared it with you, they've already have some level of trust, and if you remember it when you encounter them again, you have an opportunity for change. Encampments oftentimes grow in the initial kind of engagement because all of a few people have some options that came their way, and then word spreads and people show up and say, hey, I really need help. I was nowhere near this site and I'm moving in because I heard this is what happens. And so sometimes it can look messier before it looks like change is happening. And so that's also very important. It means that we have a good reputation, that people say, hey, you can trust these folks. They're going to work with you. They're going to figure things out. Acceptance of storage, even if they're not going to move into shelter, that at one point was a stipulation. You had to be going to somewhere that was not another camping location, or it had to be something definitive. But sometimes just someone trusting me with their belongings to know that in 90 days they could come back and get it and it will all be intact is enough for folks to say, okay, I'm going to keep engaging with you. And I don't encourage people to find another campsite, but I encourage people to find a safe place, and we'll stay in touch, and we're going to keep working on this, and we're going to engage, if anything, just around your belongings. Empathy and education I spoke to. And then finally, we are intentional about building our relationships with our community partners. Over the course of these past closings, we've collaborated with well over a dozen different partners in the community. Catholic Charities has paid their staff to join us on site, and they've done the housing assessments. This week at Cathedral Hill, they walked people down to shelter to show them what it looked like to see if they'd be comfortable and give it a shot for a night. We've had Listening House out yesterday filling out paperwork for replacement IDs so that folks can have the appropriate paperwork needed for housing applications. We have Minnesota Community Care come out for wound care and collaboration, and we bring people to the clinic as a first step into greater resources. So we really are working on creating a pathway out of homelessness, not just a one-time solution. We want to hand folks to the next step, and the next step is always one step away from where we found them, and that's the intention of where we are at this point in time as we're closing these encampments and working with folks out in the community. That is everything, and that's a lot. So if you have any questions, feel free.
Other questions? Ms. Nanker?
Thanks, Council President. I'm not sure who this is a question for, but I want to thank you first, Ms. Hinderacher, so much for the work you do and also just the eloquent way you describe it. And it's clear that this is what is going to make the difference person by person, encounter by encounter, so thank you. I'm wondering, it seems to me, whenever I hear you speak, that we have such a good way of talking about the work you're doing, the case management, the one encounter at a time, that does move people into housing over time. I'd like to have something as articulate about our higher level strategy, the work that we're also doing to make homelessness less recurrent, less, right? We're always going to have people who are going to need this service, and so it's not like one is going to replace the other, but I often hear people asking, and I don't have a good way of answering, is it just we're going to keep going to encampments, we're going to keep connecting people, then there's going to be more people, there's going to be more encampments, we're going to keep close, like the bigger picture advocacy types of shelter we need that we don't have, those kinds of questions to be able to say, we're doing these three things that together are going to X, right?
Yes. It's a great question, and it's a great segue, because my quick answer, which pulls me just a little bit out of my lane, but is the great pass off, is is that we can only do what we can do until we get to that closed door, which is affordable, accessible, low-barrier housing. We have a stopgap. What we are doing is kind of high-level triage straight through into the shelter environment, into supportive housing basic programs. But the big picture is that we have adequate housing for folks that's across the gamut of need, whether it's supported or independent or, you know, all those different things, low barrier definitely. And so if you don't mind, I might just shift over. All right. Unless there's more questions.
Let's just check quick. Mm-hmm. Are there other questions for Andrea?
No.
I meant to say this in the beginning, and you may have already figured this out, but in addition to those two screens, there's one down here, and people on that side of the table may not know that. So if we're, like, sitting here, like, not looking at you, it's because we're looking at that screen, but it's down here. And it's not abundantly clear to people who are on that side of the table. So just to let you know, we're not zoning out.
Sure.
We're looking at the exact same PowerPoint as up on the side. So, all right. I tried to say that at the beginning, and I forgot today. So, all right, Tara.
Thank you, Council President. And, yes, Councilmember Naker, you stole my thunder. I was sitting here thinking of all the brilliant ways I could articulate that their amazing work only culminates in, like, actual change if there are units to connect people to once their amazing efforts bear fruit. So I'm here to talk about that aspect of it and how we are addressing the lack of available units for folks. And I think you've seen, I'm not sure if you've seen this slide before, but I think I've shared this information at least with you before, but it really bears repeating because we've been talking about the need to provide more deeply affordable housing for years. And it's still been really, really hard to do. And that kind of is evident in this table here where you see that the number of deeply affordable units created in the city, permitted, has been a pretty small number. There's been a couple outlier years when there has been something like the Dorothy Day development has gone up. But for the most part, we have a really, really hard time addressing deeply affordable housing needs, commensurate to the need, than we do of even other levels of affordability that just aren't quite that dire. And so there's been this effort to sort of say, why are we building so much less at 30% AMI than we are at 31 to say 60% AMI, the more moderate levels of affordable housing? And the answer is that it's a lot harder and it takes a lot more money and it gets a lot more complex because there's associated wraparound services that there has to be a connection to and a relationship with, especially when we talk about addressing some of those lower barriers. So it's just a little bit more complex, but it doesn't mean that we can't do it. And one of the silver linings, you could say, of the pandemic would be that this ARPA funding came in and was guided to support the creation of deeply affordable housing units. And so through our first solicitation, as you all know, this spring, we were able to award funding to support the creation of 110 deeply affordable units, which is a really big deal across five projects. Again, you'll find a couple outlier years if you really go back and dig for a couple decades of production of deeply affordable housing outlier years, but those were one-off projects that provided a lot of units in that 1 year. So this is a huge impact, and we have more ARPA money coming out in the fall for this very same need, and I'm really excited about that, but I'm also really aware that once that ARPA money goes away, we're back to the same challenging situation, which is how do we use our traditional housing resources like bonds and TIF and tax credits to achieve more of these deeply affordable units, and how do we do a better job of making sure those deeply affordable units are the type of units that actually serve the folks that Andrea and Maggie are helping get out of a tent and into a home. So that leads to the next slide, which is simply kind of how are we thinking about that and strategy and next steps. So I mentioned the first ARPA solicitation. You know, I am incredibly excited about the number of units we're able to fund with that, and knowing that we still have approximately $20 million available to try to fund additional units. I would estimate around 100 additional deeply affordable units could potentially be funded this fall, adding to the amount of units we funded and will likely be permitted and or available as early as 2023. We also are looking at that second solicitation because the first solicitation was really designed to address existing affordable housing developments in our pipeline, most of which did not have deeply affordable units in them. And so our first ARPA round kind of really focused on, can we get those projects to the finish line and deepen the affordability of some of those units? And so we looked really at that prioritization. And so of those five projects we funded, four of them are mixed income projects that have some deeply affordable units in them, but are not probably going to be the low barrier, deeply affordable units that are going to help serve folks that Andrea and Maggie are working with. One of the projects we funded was, and that was great, a deeply affordable and deeply supportive housing project of 17 units. But I say all that to say that in the second solicitation, I'm really interested in how we can encourage and fund more of the supportive deeply affordable units to really address this space between where folks are kind of getting temporarily managed in their unsheltered needs and where folks have an actual unit to go to. Additional efforts are to continue, that's kind of what I was just saying, continue to build bridges. You know, we, on my team, we are talking a lot with affordable housing developers, and we're getting better at the conversation around how to pair the right housing with the right service providers and how to understand that in our underwriting and our deals and the real estate processes that we understand. How are we connecting to that better? Planning for longer-term sources, I address that as well. And then I just want to kind of add, and this is connected to the presentation I was able to give the HRA board around kind of longer-term housing strategy, is I really think the more we can continue to nuance the data and understand the needs at a deeper level, the better we can respond and be and make really good decisions using the like priorities that with the best information that we have. So we know we need a lot more units affordable at 30% of AMI. How many of those are units that really just could be added to a project of, you know, a mixed unit project and really help a family that doesn't have a ton of wraparound service needs but simply doesn't make a lot of money? And then what is the need that really does need this this wraparound services, and what are they, and how can we not continue to maybe fund a project that has this type of wraparound service and realize that we're really addressing this need well, but we've forgotten about these two needs, whether we're talking about issues with finding large enough bedroom sizes that are affordable at 30% AMI, or criminal history and how that impacts access to housing, all the different ways that barriers can prevent access to housing, even if the units are there. My plan is to prioritize, revisit the data, and really be able to forecast future needs as nuanced as possible and plan accordingly. And consider that we could be looking at, you know, years more of a pandemic or not, that we really don't know for sure what the future looks like. So some aspects of scenario planning that look at a couple different ways this could go and have some plan A and plan B and plan Cs. And then really looking at a place-based equity analysis, and I want to do this across all types of affordable housing and all types of housing really in the city, but certainly in the space of deeply affordable housing where low barrier needs need to be met. I think, you know, I want to understand better where in the city those needs are, how they're most connected, and if we are getting the proposals we want for the parts of the city that we want, and the kind of housing balance that really creates resilient communities while addressing the need for folks sometimes to be living close to where they work or where they have services or where they have community. So that's a little bit more about what we're thinking about on the development side and how we're planning to move forward to be good partners and actually create the types of units that can get us to, brief, if ever, homelessness and the goals of this work. So I'll stop there for questions.
And this is probably something that the county manager can follow up with as well, but we're talking about a Ramsey County problem, which actually far exceeds the boundaries of Ramsey County, as we know, right? We're serving Wright County here, too. But St. Paul is coming up with the solutions for housing. So I'd like to also understand how the greater Ramsey County is coming up with, and I know there's been investment in deeply affordable housing, so just understanding how other cities in Ramsey County are contributing to the solution as well would be helpful to hear, even though this is a St. Paul group in front of you, but I think that oftentimes we disproportionately serve the state in the greater metro area as St. Paul. So just understanding how the Ramsey County, the work of Ramsey County is also tied into the solution here and the kind of upstream piece of this. Welcome.
Madam President, council members, thanks for the opportunity to be here today. First, kudos to the three presenters who did an excellent job. I would be remiss, I got to lean over and say to the deputy mayor, but I do think in the arc of our work across the homeless and housing continuum, which Councilmember Naker, to your earlier question, we have a visual we could send that shows you got to stop talking about homelessness over here and housing over here because the solution to this is over here. And our team has done a nice job with a visual that I saw just a couple weeks ago, and we can make sure that comes back as a follow-up. Specific to your – oh, so my – sorry, on the ARC piece there, I got lost in my own thought. You know, 2 years ago, this conversation would have been the two of us sitting here trying to give a full update with, like, a couple of throw-ins from some people who were cobbling it together as a plus thing in their job. And the infrastructure you're starting to see built around the various elements of work that need to come together across a continuum and in work with community at the continuum of care is really an impressive investment by both the city and the county. We had no housing stability office before COVID. We had no HRA before COVID. You had no encampment management HART team and many of these other elements of work. And I want to acknowledge the staff who presented today and the others. And it heartens me having been the person who at different moments took the call on certain nights of like, we have 14 people sleeping out in a parking lot. What are we going to do? And it's like, we didn't even know where to go on the next call, right? To your question specifically, I don't have numbers for all of our cities, but if you've been paying attention both publicly or even just on the side, I think you would know that we continue to go back and forth with many of our communities about the need for affordable housing that go beyond what often gets deemed as enough. And I don't think that's limited to one community. I don't think that's only in Ramsey County. That's a nationwide issue. Oftentimes, I find myself wanting to just say, I appreciate what you just shared. We need to go farther and deeper because we're 15,000 units short at this 30% AMI level in Ramsey County. And the more local you get, the more challenging, as all of you know, these issues of housing production can become. So I don't feel like I can fully summarize what every individual city is doing today. That's an ongoing piece, and every city looks a little bit different. Some cities are far closer to adhering to their comp plan goals, which are still not aggressive enough, in my view, for what we need. But other cities are – that's more of an aspiration or a thing they put down with less commitment to it. Specific to the county side, which is slightly different, right? I would just like to note in the numbers you saw today on the investments in affordable housing, we all got to stand together a few months ago. You could double the numbers and the production if you include the Ramsey County half of this, which means that you're seeing it's not 110 units that have come into production at that space. It's approximately 220, right? And so what's heartening to that is you're seeing the St. Paul piece to it, but because we work together here, and kudos to St. Paul's HRA leadership and working with county staff, that only paints half of that picture. And so where our units get distributed will have impact in those suburban communities. But part of our ask is we're not going to be the only funder and producer of affordable housing in our communities. We need to see cities join us at that table to leverage our $11 million a year.
Right, because a significant number of the units Ramsey County is adding are in St. Paul.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. We do have suburban projects that came in the pipeline and continue to. I actually find that when it's the county's money on the table, you find developers who are willing, ready, and able. We need to get other municipal resources to the table to help leverage that further and truly build that web as you described.
Yeah. And we're good at this. We're proud of the work we do, and I think that we just are often looking to our suburban counterparts to match the work that we're doing here. And I really applaud the leadership of the board and you in terms of pushing that. We added affordable housing, but it was senior housing. And we need senior housing here in St. Paul, too. We need senior housing everywhere, but we need to do more of the deeply affordable for families, for adults. So I appreciate that update and the connecting of the dots.
I have a follow-up question.
Mr. Lally.
Thank you. To follow up on that, I don't know, I'm loud enough. to follow up on that, I think that seeing our shared American Rescue Plan investments kind of side by side is really powerful. And even this slide that we're on, like 2019, 2020, 2021, and then the jump, it just lays out very clearly how public investment that matches or even begins to approximate the need has tremendous impact. I would have loved to have seen the 2022 numbers in like 1980, 1979, 1969. Like, we are catching up from decades of federal disinvestment. And I know that you know that. It is just every time we have these conversations in the 2022 realm, I just kind of zoom out and I think about like the scale of what we are trying to combat now. And one of the things I was curious about, and maybe you just covered it and I didn't catch it, but I thought that Ramsey County adopting a gap financing levy was a really important step. And I know that there's federal funds, but then there's also just the county using its taxing authority to literally raise the resources from often much wealthier suburban communities to kind of meet the countywide needs. And how does that fit into everything that we're talking about and just adding more resource to address this kind of system-wide?
Madam President, Councilmember Jalali, and please feel free to add anything if I miss it from our perspective here too. I appreciate that comment, and I appreciate the work of this council supporting the county board and moving forward on an HRA levy. There's a lot of history for why it hadn't happened in this county for a really long time, and I think one of the more significant things that's happened from where I sit in the last few years was seeing the board enact that levy as a part of this biennial budget as it was proposed. And we did it at the statutory maximum. It generates approximately $11 million a year right now based on that formula. That is $11 million going directly into this every single year beyond ARPA. And the other, and that matters. The $50 million that we've cobbled together the last 2 years also highlights that $11 million doesn't fully address the magnitude of what we wish we could do. And the only other part I want to underscore that you raised, when I first started with the county, I was in a meeting with former Deputy Mayor Ann Mulholland. We were in a conversation around homelessness, and we were at the point when we were seeing unsheltered numbers three and a half times what we see even right now. And she was very eloquent in explaining to me, who had much less understanding in the space, how federal disinvestment tracks very clearly with an uptick in homelessness and unsheltered homelessness. And honestly, that's not a hard connection to make, but I just had never spent time paying attention. And so our biggest ask right now, Commissioner Mary Jo McGuire is the next National Association of Counties president stepping into the role next year, as well as the state association president. That's never happened before. And to have that level of Minnesota leadership at both a state and national level, one of our biggest pushes right now in current conversations with the administration, she was at the White House a few weeks ago on this, is that we need to see the infrastructure investments specifically around housing continue beyond ARPA for the reasons you cited.
And just a dot connect to connect it back, not to turn this into our coffee chat, but but it is the national point is something that I think is important for all of us to hold and figure out how to keep coordinating even better, because we need people representing our counties to be lobbying at the national level. We need to track and figure out how to take advantage of things like, I thought that the Biden White House rolled out a proposal to your point of like suburban municipalities just not doing their work. They basically had a federal vision for, if you get rid of these zoning and parking and other onerous requirements and basically like relax restrictions on housing getting built locally, there's federal funding tied to that. There's federal reward tied to that. So I do think that we're slowly seeing the ship like turn in the direction we need, but it just will take all of us coordinating on every front to make sure people are doing their part. So this is helpful for me understanding that, and thank you.
Ms. Nicker.
Thanks, Council President. Two questions for, I think, you both. One, we've talked about the need for specific kinds of shelter that we don't have now, and I know that the COC is talking about specifically the need for this high-needs shelter. can maybe one or both of you speak to the work on that? And then the second question is, and I agree with what Ms. Jalali just said, and we talk about it all the time. I feel like this conversation always comes back to, and we need help from other levels of government. We saw this year, despite coordinated and I thought very compelling advocacy to the state, that we fell far short of where we wanted to be in a year of immense abundance. I'm wondering what the strategy is for that advocacy to continue, to become more effective, and not just on a one-time basis, but for an ongoing dependable revenue stream, because I think the council president's entirely right. We want affordable housing and shelter built everywhere, and we know they're likely to still be concentrations of people coming here, which we want because we have services here and that makes sense, and we need to be compensated for it by the state. So I know we've been at tables where there have been 60 of us sitting around with commissioners talking about this. I don't know where those have gone. I'd love to know what we're thinking about that advocacy in the long term.
Council member, I'll start. So we do have a couple of things that, and I know that the council has been very helpful in supporting an earmark request for a familiar faces pilot. So we feel pretty optimistic at a federal level. We have very strong support from our federal delegation for an earmark for that programming. So to the needs around where we still see those gaps, where it's really high acuity levels for the individuals that we're seeing on the streets that are cycling in and out of crisis. They're showing up in our courts. They're showing up in response to 911 calls. And we just need to match what is that need to get them out of that continual crisis. So we're hopeful that that's a federal space that we can pull down some resources. There's also HUD just released a new notice of funding opportunity, which the COC is going to aggressively pursue, dedicated to the unsheltered space. So there's some additional federal resources that we'll continue to go after. Your second question was more around the advocacy. My experience of this legislative session was our community coming together as a COC and going to the legislature and really doing a lot of education around what we learned during COVID, how we in St. Paul and Ramsey County are partnering to be nimble and add resources and capacity to really address what we're seeing on the ground and ask for the resources to help make that possible moving forward. And so in personal conversations that I had with legislators, it was a real education. And they would ask things like, but how do you solve it? And it's like, okay, well, let's have another one of these whole meetings. But I feel like when we go to the legislature next year, we've built this foundation. And I think what we achieved this last session was we would hear people in committee meetings. They would praise St. Paul and Ramsey County for the partnership, for, you know, all of our levels of government coming together and saying we're just going to figure out how to address it with compassion and strategy. And so I feel confident that we're going to be able to go back and secure resources into the future and that support that we need.
If I could just add a couple of pieces, Madam President. To the first question on the funding, I think the one other specific spot that the COC is going to have an opportunity here to be a part of, in addition to the federal resources, is that when Maggie presented the piece around the $6 million and the $4.5 million that allocated right away, there is now an opportunity, whether we wanted it or not, just based on kind of how the responses worked and the timelines we're working under and what capacity existed, to think about how to leverage that remaining $1.5 million into some of those gap areas through more creative, smaller dollar amount funding. So if it's, for example, couples with pets, where we continue to see an encampment-related challenge heading toward this winter, well, we have $1.5 million that we could think about how we're putting that money out differently. And I know that's the conversation happening right now, is we had to do these big blunt instrument RFPs first to really just build the capacity back up. But then it's the question of how do you now address some of those other pieces of gaps. I think we're going to learn a lot through that financing, and thanks to the governor's office again for the money that's allowing us to do it. I'll only add on the state advocacy side. I am just hopeful that we keep our foot to the pedal, because I think we were heard, and I think a lot of people wanted to do more, and broader environments that had nothing to do with us just got in the way of that, with an election year and ugly partisanship and everything else. Most of that money, the money we need, still sits there. And while I would love long-term funding streams, so don't get me wrong, I think we should figure out how to always advocate for it. We asked for that 5 years and $75 million bridge to this production of affordable housing starting to catch up. I still think that's the right ask. You just subtract $6 million from it now. And so you're at about $69 million, and you're asking for about 4 years. And the state's surplus right now, in terms of cash and its bonding capacity, like, this is not an outlandish request. And I just think that, we got to go back together, and we need your help.
We're in. So switching gears a little bit, I really appreciate what Ms. Hinderacher was saying about, you know, our past practices being like closed down encampments, and it was like a quick fix solution, and you're working on a more long-term empathetic solution. I also recognize that it's challenging for the city and neighbors, law enforcement, DSI, to have inconsistent enforcement of our policies. For a while, up by the area I represent, people would camp outside of the parks building so that they could be the first one to get the best pavilion for their wedding. And that was okay, I guess. People could just camp there for a few nights because, you know, then they could get the best spot for their wedding. But the problem was there's no restrooms. There's no places for people to wash their hands. People were camping, and it was getting to be a longer and longer situation. Ultimately, they had to switch the process for which they switched to a lottery process online as opposed to a whoever's camping out here the longest wins. But we're seeing this on Kellogg Boulevard now. And there's people camping for the best spot. And I find it outrageous, actually, that we are letting teenagers camp out on Kellogg Boulevard, and when we don't have, there's not camping allowed in the city. I've also noticed people pushing the boundaries and camping. This weekend, somebody had a tent between the parking lot and the walking path at Como Lake. Absolutely not fitting the descriptions of anything that you said today, just pushing the boundaries. But then police not knowing or DSI not knowing where their authority began and ended. And it's just a real challenge, and I'm not saying anyone's right or wrong, but I feel like we're in that funky gray area, and it's hard for me to know how to respond when someone's like, why is there a tent by Como Pool? And I'm like, I really don't know. So I'm hoping that as this program continues to evolve, that we're able to say, you know, the folks that are here are working in this on these steps to get to a different outcome, and be able to kind of catalog that in a way that we can say to the people who are camping here on Kellogg, well, first of all, to the XL, like, figure out a different way to do your general admission. I mean, there's a solution to that problem. What do we do when people are just pushing the boundaries, and so that we have at least some consistency within our inconsistency? Because it is challenging, and I don't know if I was on the enforcement side, you know, what do you do? Well, you can do this sometimes. You can do this if it's here. It just gets a little funky. So I just want to, like, just name that and say that I'm looking forward to, you know, being able to establish sort of some criteria around the consistency within our inconsistency, because it is a challenge, and I understand why there's frustration and confusion about, like, what is allowed and what's not allowed and what are we doing here and why aren't we doing it here, as you said, about timing and other things. So, more, I don't know if there's really an answer to that, but just what I'm seeing.
Council President, I really appreciate that, and that's one of the reasons we put our standard operating procedures for closures in writing, so that as conditions change, as we learn more, as our team gets established and we have more of that by name registry and we know exactly what's happening with each individual, we now have an ability where 2 years ago we couldn't make those dissections in the way that we can now because we have so much intelligence. And so we welcome the conversations. You know, as you know, there's a legal framework, there's for each of those conditions. And so I think the city grappling through what do we do in each of these cases, we welcome that. And so we can make sure that the council members have the most updated copy of our policy procedures. And then we can just continue to talk it through, because even what we're seeing, you know, this year is different than last year, and our understanding of what's going on for folks is deeper. So,
yeah, I just think it's confusing. Okay. Like I know I called. There was a encampment going up, and a lot of raucous activity that was concerning across from on Como Avenue near Pennsylvania. And when I called dispatch, I say, can someone just drive past here and see what's going on? They're like, well, is it on private property or public property? I was like, I don't know. Well, why don't you call code on Monday? I'm like, what? It was the strangest. And I think that person was also confused. Just like, I don't really know what I'm supposed to do with this. She said, they might have permission. I'm like, I'm pretty sure they don't. But in any case, I don't know what to do with this. And I think that the call wasn't like, go get them. It was like, things are funky here. Maybe someone should drive by. And I think ultimately that's what happened. But I could definitely tell there was some confusion just within kind of that consistency piece. Do you were about to follow up?
Well, Madam President, just wanted to make sure I didn't dodge your opioid question earlier.
Okay, thanks.
I wrote it down and said I would come back to it.
I have a circle around it on my paper.
Well, we can follow up specifically on that piece. Public Health has still been working on figuring out exactly the approach to how they want to use the opioid funding. So, it's both like a lot of money and not a lot of money. It's $24 million over 18 years if you combine the city and county allocation. And so when you think about the scourge of opioids and the redress you're trying to do, that feels – I don't mean to sound, like sad that we got money, but at the same time, it just feels like such a small piece with the profits made. But Director Holly is working to develop the plan that both engages with community so that they have a voice in the most appropriate ways to do it. And that's coming back to the board, I know, this fall, so you'll be able to get some more information around that time as well. But this was a good question to raise today. The only other thing I want to say before I leave, because I just think it's important, and it's a conversation we get to have, but we warned that if we didn't get the money earlier during the session, we knew there would be an encampment challenge this summer just based on the timelines we were working on. And it doesn't make us geniuses. It's just we've been through this for a number of years, right? The good news is the funding now is moving into the phase of the RFP process and where it's going to go. We will see those numbers come down. And it won't maybe go right to zero, but we're going to see those numbers coming down this fall and as it gets cold. And I just want to appreciate – I know it's been a tough summer, particularly in elected seats where you get those phone calls. Everybody's been doing their best to respond. And by the time this winter comes, just thankfully we're going to be in a stronger spot than we were this summer.
Well, I think just having these regular updates helps us answer the questions. Like, what's happening? What's going on? Why is this, why? And if based on the information that we heard from Maggie, from Andrea, from Tara, like, it makes it a lot easier for us to say, hey, actually, we're aware of this, and here's what we're doing. And I think a lot of times, it's just like when you go to the doctor and you don't feel good, and as soon as they tell you what you have, you feel better, even though you still feel terrible. But at least you know. And I think that helps us be those messengers that share, this is the system, and actually it's working. Little by little, person by person, day by day. So this update is really helpful for us, as to your point, Ryan, as people in elected seats who get those calls, to be able to message back what's really happening here at the city and in the county. Mr. Lally.
Well, and to add on to that, like when people see somebody outside who is struggling, the average person just thinks of like city, city, city. Who's my city councilperson? Who's the mayor? Whoever. And it is not that we shouldn't be accountable for doing our part. It's that it's like lots of folks don't make the connection that there's like multiple levels of policy and funding choices behind like that person's situation. And it's happening in your neighborhood. So you think that the whole purview of it is like just this one unit of government. And actually like every single one of us has to do our part. And I appreciate these conversations always because I feel like our level of coordination is closer than it has ever been, perhaps like ever. And it's like 2022 and we finally reached that part, and like people before us who had these roles before us, like they didn't take up that responsibility. And so we're in it. So, I think about that when people are narrowing the unsheltered homelessness conversation to be really small when really it's like there's so many pieces. Frankly, I think there's a parallel to like gun violence. There's so many things fueling gun violence, but people think of it as like purely a city thing, which is problematic. Every single level of government and society has to do their part. So I just offer that as it's just kind of rounding out how I'm thinking about all this today. And I am always deeply, deeply grateful for your combined work and these updates. So thank you.
Thank you. Other comments before we switch gears to our Right Track interns who are sweating it out in the seats? We're good? Mr. Tolbert.
Yeah, I just want to echo that. And also, I think having more regular updates on this is helpful for us and helps us articulate it to the public as well. But I just want to appreciate the partnership that everybody's working on this together. Obviously, we all have the same goals, and sometimes we have different opinions on how to get there or different needs and weigh things, but the collaboration between the city and county is helpful, and I hope our, as Council President Bredmon has mentioned a few times, our suburban neighbors also step up to the plate and join us in this important effort because it's the right thing to do. And anyways, I just want to thank everybody in here for their hard work.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. We will move on. We invite you to stay. If you have a few moments,
what's the order?
Okay, because we will now hear from the Right Track interns.
Yay!
Thanks very much for your report, for your time. All right. It's always hardest to go first. Abshire, Ali, 4-2, but someone's got to do it.
We're never afraid. We're never afraid.
Yeah, someone's got to do it, and you're doing it. So let's go. Welcome.
Thank you, Council President and Council Members. My name is Abshire Ali. I'm the Ward 2 intern for Council Member Breckenacre. And yeah. So a little bit about me. I'm 16 years old. I'll be going to Highland in the fall as a junior. And before this internship, I was the chair and still the chair of the St. Paul Youth Commission. I'm on other commissions like the Capital Improvement Budget Committee, which is the committee that recommends capital improvements like parks and sidewalks, anything city-owned. I'm also a temporary member of the Chief of Police Examining Committee. As you all know, they're looking for a new chief. So that's the committee that finds applicants. The Youth on Boards program is a program which puts youth on commissions and boards and that kind of stuff. I think you guys are all familiar with it. I'm a representative for them. I co-lead sometimes, and I also find people that can serve on boards, youth that can serve on boards. So this whole internship was very good. I had a lot of fun. Some of my favorite activities were the pothole filling, which is when we went out with Public Works and we filled potholes in the Ward 7, and it was very intensive, but also very fun at the same time. Some other activities we did was the district energy, which is right there. We toured a bit, and it gave some insight into things that go behind the scenes into giving electricity to the St. Paul. The 911 dispatch center, me and a couple of other interns and council president, we went to the Ramsey Emergency Center, and it's very eye-opening. You don't really think what happens behind the 911 call, but yeah, very eye-opening. And I went on a police ride-along with Officer Frank Ortiz, and yeah, it was very fun. We went out to a couple calls. So in general, my experience as the Ward 2 intern in the city council was very good. Nothing short of amazing. I had a lot of fun while also making a lot of connections and building relationships with the staff and other interns. I'm very grateful for the experience. I think I'll cherish it for the rest of my life, and I'll be glad to have you guys all in my reference and network, and yeah. So my policy special project was human waste. I think every metropolitan city is dealing with human waste. So I just like looked at other cities, what they did to combat this problem and how we can mirror it or make it better. It's if you go downtown St. Paul, I think you'll see a lot of evidence of this problem. And so I researched a little bit and see what we can do, and I made a list of things we can try to do to combat this problem. So the number one is increasing the number of public restrooms. I think St. Paul in general is good in this area, but I think we can do it better. In terms of when we look at the Skyway, that's where we have a lot of problems with human waste, and I don't think there's public restrooms in the Skyway. So that's one thing. The second thing is enacting and enforcing anti-public urination and defecation legislation. This just goes on to the broader view of enforcing laws or laws that are already there and harsher penalties to make St. Paul more livable and more and get St. Paul a better image. Raising public awareness of the problem and its implication for the community. This goes on to the broader image of educating the community and maybe flyers and like educating teens about how this affects badly in the community. Collaborating with local businesses to increase employee and public access to restrooms. I've been to some of these businesses in downtown St. Paul, and you have to pay to use it, or sometimes it's not even there. There's no access to restrooms, so I think it's something we can do with the private sector to work out a plan. Increased funding for public restroom upkeeping and cleaning. Most of the public restrooms are very, so to say, very unsanitary, so that's something we can work on to combat this problem. And yeah, I just want to thank Councilmember Rebecca, Legislator Aitana, and my EA, Kayla, for helping me in this internship. Yeah.
Awesome. I don't know if Ms. Naker mentioned this to you or not, but literally this morning I sent her a story about Minneapolis trying to open 100 free restrooms in downtown. It's a dated story, but I was just like, we should really work on this. Abshir is. So that's great, very timely. And we've talked about, you know, you can't have rules about public urination if there's no place for people to go. I mean, we need to have a solution before we can enforce on the back end of that. So good problem that you chose. Yeah. Thank you very much. I think we probably have to keep on time. Did you want to comment?
I can't not comment. I just want to let that go. Can't wait to talk public restrooms with you right after this, because it is true. There's so much synchronicity about what you just said. It's been such a pleasure to work with you, and I'm so excited to be a reference for you. And I just feel like we hit the jackpot by having you in our office this year. So thank you so much for everything you've done.
Thank you. Yeah. All right, Freya Boats, Ward 5.
Hello, City Council, Council President and Council Members. Thank you for the opportunity to speak this morning. My name is Freya Boats. I'll be a senior at Two Rivers High School this fall. I live on the west side in Ward 2, and I'm this summer's Ward 5 summer intern. Over the summer, most of my time was spent here at City Hall working in the Ward 5 office. A lot of things I did were writing, working on, and creating a new format for the Ward 5 newsletter. I did community outreach for those who were moved into Ward 5 because of recent redistricting and this year's census. I attended legislative hearings and the weekly city council meetings. I toured Ward 5. I had one-on-ones with council members, and we did lots of meet and greets and tours with city departments. The first tour we did was at the St. Paul Regional Water Service facility. I found this really interesting because this one facility sends water to most of the metro area, and I learned a lot of things that I wish I had known before, even. For example, that you have to run the water in the morning before you drink water, and that hot water from your tap shouldn't be consumed, not even to boil pasta or anything. The next tour we went on was with Public Works, and we did pothole filling and street maintenance. A big thank you to Right Track for the steel toe boots, because they're not something that I regularly wear or even own, so thank you. A big thing we learned was the large scope of responsibilities that Public Works employees have. For example, in the summer, they maintain streets, traffic control. In the winter, they plow, they have to salt for ice, and all year round, they have to clean up roadkill and dead animals, which Gonu and Jessica and I had a very personal experience with, you won't forget. we also learned that shoveling asphalt is harder than it looks, even if I make it look easy in the picture. Another tour we went on was of the Highland Bridge site. This is a really cool space. It's 122 acres of privately owned public space with affordable housing, retail, office space, civic space, and four new parks, which is a huge gift to the Highland community. It's really cool to see. We also saw the Ramsey County 911 call dispatch center, which I would have put pictures up, but it's confidential. We can take pictures. This was really cool. We learned a lot about, you know, the emergency service procedure, and we learned that the most calls happen at 4 p.m. in the middle of June, which I found interesting personally. Other small tours we went on were of the Skyways and of City Hall, and can't forget about Starbucks and lunch runs with my interns. Shout out to them. Moving on to the second part of my internship, about a third of my time was spent with the Rice and Larpenter Alliance, which is a group that brings together the three cities, of Maplewood, Roseville, and St. Paul, because the intersection of Rice and Larpenter is where the three cities meet. This is where we planned their summer block party, and I had a role in this by being on the planning committee. I reached out and canvassed with the community for this event, and I coordinated volunteers at the event. Overall, I'm very grateful for my experience here, and I'm grateful to everyone that made it happen. I learned a lot, I gained a lot of valuable skills, and most importantly, I met a lot of awesome people here. I want to say a shout out to Ward 5 for the warm welcomes, for not judging my questions, and for all of the enthusiasm and kindness. I really appreciate you guys. Thank you.
Thank you. I know when you were preparing this, a lot of the other interns had a particular project they were working on, and you're like, I didn't work on a project. And Jessica was like, what about Rice Larpenter? And you're like, oh, Rice Larpenter, which is a huge project in Ward 5, and we're really grateful that you stepped up and helped with that. They need all the help they can get, and I love the pictures from that day. So thank you for your whole the experience here has been great for us as well. And this is an excellent summary. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Council President, Council Members. Wait, can you guys hear me? Okay. Thank you guys for having me today and having me this entire summer, really. A little bit about me. I'm a Right Track summer intern for Council Member Tolbert this year. I was born and raised in St. Paul. I live in the North End area in Ward 5. We are a senior this year at Washington Tech, and I recently joined the St. Paul Youth Commissions. So I'm really excited to continue working in politics and government, this time through the lens of a young person. And I hope this means that we'll continue seeing each other and working together in the future. So I did a lot of things this summer as an intern. Some of these things included attending public meetings and hearings. I went on tours with the other ward offices, and we went to the Como Zoo, District Energy, St. Paul Regional Water Services, and Public Works Department. I also wrote newsletters and developed a policy research project on reproductive rights, and that presentation will be tomorrow. So if any of you are interested, you're all more than welcome to come join. I also attended community events all over St. Paul and built strong relationships with other interns and city staff. And personally, some of my personal highlights throughout this internship was attending the St. Paul Regional Water Service tour. And one of my favorite things was reading articles, city documents, and magazines. These things made me feel very present and in the moment because I got to know these things before it was even published. And I also got to know more things in detail than other readers know. And these things, I got to ask people questions. And versus if I was at home doing this, then I would have to send an email and wait 3 to 5 business days for a response. I also learned the process of city appeals, how ordinances and amendments are created, and gained a really deep understanding of what it's like to work in the government. And here's some pictures. On the left side, on the top left, is a picture of the Ward 3 and Ward 5 offices at the St. Paul Regional Water Services place. And we're looking at a map of the water pipes in the metro area. And on the bottom left is a picture of the interns, Freya, Paul, and Abshir, and I, eating lunch in the conference rooms. And in the main picture is the Ward 3 team office and I, Councilmember Tober, Adam Hughes, and Marvelyn Tripp. Also, I just want to say a quick thank you to the entire City Hall staff, all the legislative aides, executive assistants, city hearing officers, anyone who worked on this on the third floor. I feel like I should be turning to you guys. Thank you guys for contributing to this amazing experience, including me into the work you guys do, and just making a safe space for me to ask questions. Yeah. Also, especially to Adam and Marvelyn, those two work so hard together and contribute above and beyond work to our city. And especially to Adam, I talked to numerous people about their career and their career paths, and I learned that the career that I want and the person I want to become has actually been working with me this entire time.
Aww.
So, really, yeah. And also just being here these last 2 months, I think working at the City Hall has really saved my mental health. I'd be really bored and miserable if I was at home. And this past school year has been really difficult for St. Paul Public School students and a lot of people. And I think this internship was kind of my reward, that light at the end of the tunnel kind of thing. So I really appreciate being here and working with all of you. Thank you. And thank you, Councilmember Tolbert, for having me as your intern this summer. And I hope all of you continue to have interns in future summers. Thank you.
Before you leave.
Can't run away yet.
Thank you.
Well, I just want to thank you for being a part of our office. It was always fun to, especially to watch the chemistry between Adam, Marvelyn, and you, and just do a lot of work. And I just tried to stay out of the way in a lot of the work that you did. But I think one picture that is missing, and I think it's important for my colleagues to know, is Gonu sat at the council president seat yesterday, and we put Nelsie's, she shares the same last name as Nelsie, so we put Nelsie's name tag there, and it just, I think we're all, we can see the we just saw the future yesterday of this council, and we know that we'll be in good hands when you're a council member running the city council. Now you'll know how to do it, since you've watched many do it well. So thank you, and best of luck, and I'm saying this to you and everybody in here, but one of the benefits of RightTrack is creating a huge network, and I think everybody in here has created a huge network, and we're all willing to help you. If you see jobs in the future, if you see opportunities in the future and you have questions about them or need references, you know that we're here to do that. And I know I'm speaking for myself, but I suspect my colleagues are 100% behind that as well. So please use us as you move forward and take over the city, and all of you guys do well when we're long gone.
And definitely take this energy into your senior year. It sounds like it's been like kind of, you know, been draining, and so hopefully you've had a chance to like charge up your energy, and you're ready to go into that senior year and take it by storm. Because we're so impressed with you, and we really appreciate the energy that you've brought to us.
Oh, thank you. I always say I reflect other people's energy, so really it's you guys. Thank you.
Paul, it's hardest to go last. I'm just kidding.
I said it was hardest to go first. Oh, another Ward 5 resident. Welcome.
Thank you, Council President, Council members. My name is Paul Nguyen, and I'm the RightTrack intern for Council Member Nelsie Yang and the Ward 6 office. So, recently, I just graduated from Central High School. I will be attending McAllister College in the fall to study political science. And the reason why I took on this internship was because I was just really interested in studying politics. And last summer, when I volunteered at a food shelf, I was just really inspired helping my local community. And I just felt like this was the thing I was passionate about. So some of my favorite experiences as an intern, I attended council meetings, and I just really enjoyed going to public hearings and listening to those because I was just able to see the impact of what the city council has done for people and just see how grateful or sometimes how people react to some of these ordinances. And so it's just really interesting to hear from that. I also attended community events with my supervisor, Chris Chong. We went to Plaza del Sol, where I was just able to really see the constituents of Ward 6 and understand their concerns and what they needed for their area. And I just felt like it really connected me with the ward. Now, in addition to this, I also went on some tours. This included the City Hall, and a lot of people in City Hall actually hadn't been on this tour, so it was just really great to meet everybody and just go on this tour. We also went to Como Zoo, which is just a really great public amenity because it's a really nice free service for people in St. Paul and Minnesota to just go to and really explore the nature. And we also went to Public Works, filling potholes with that one, so it was a lot of work. And we also went to the Ramsey County Emergency Call Center. I don't know if I was supposed to make this photo private or not, but I'm just gonna put it out there. So
I just think we couldn't take them in the dispatch room.
Yeah, that's what I was
thinking. That one's okay.
And then lastly, just exploring downtown St. Paul with my boss and all the other interns and the people here. For my special project, I really decided to do housing justice because seeing St. Paul as a majority of renters, I felt like housing was just a really important issue in St. Paul. It also really addresses stability, and being able to have a house means that you'll be able to have employment, a good education, and just being able to have a good well-being for yourself. And so I've seen St. Paul work towards this goal through tenant protections, which were repealed, and also rent stabilization, which is still going on right now, and we're still working on that. Throughout my research, I was just able to learn how ordinances were created and how city legislature goes through all these processes of going through each department in the city and going to talk to everybody about what we need to do to make the city better. If I were to stay, I think the next part of my research would most likely to just be to study the St. Paul City Charters and kind of understand like what we can do to make the policy work for St. Paul residents and also just make it work for also landlords and tenants and just making sure that everybody has a say in what the policy can be. And lastly, I just want to give a special thanks to the Ward 6 office. There's Chris, who's not here today because he's on vacation. Nelsie, who's on maternity leave. And also, I just really want to thank Jenna for always being here and supporting my questions and making sure that I have everything done right. And so, yeah. I also just want to give a quick thanks to Chris, too, and because he's always been really helpful. He's made my internship more positive and just really exciting to be in. And thank you to Councilmember Nelsie Yang for just being able to give me the chance to intern here, and I hope you take other interns as well. And lastly, I just want to give a big thanks to the city staff for being so helpful and always making sure that we were supported in every way. I really want to thank the legislative aides, the council members, the executive assistants, the front desk workers. Thank you, Raquel. And I just really want to thank everybody who's really helped me throughout my research. And, yeah, so every day I walk into these doors, I know that it's going to be a great day, and I really enjoyed my time here, and I hope to return again someday. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. Paul, on behalf of Councilmember Yang and all of us, we're just so glad to see you grow and just really feel like you've identified some really important policies to study. And I hope that you stay tuned because we are working on rent stabilization right now. We are planning to work on tenant protections, like a second round of them, and all of that is kind of in progress. So I hope that that research helps you as you follow along. And then I'm happy to hear you're going to a St. Paul school not nearby, so
so good luck at McAllister, and also just stay in touch with us. We might still need interns and people who understand the city now, so don't lose connection with us. But, yeah, anything else my colleagues want to share on behalf of Councilwoman Yang, happy to let you share, too.
Mr. Tollery.
Yeah, I just want to say this generally. I didn't want to say it before the last presentation, but I know folks were probably nervous. We all get nervous, including us, I think, before we have to give presentations or things like that. But when you go back to high school, when you go on to college, I know you're going to college, a few others will be in college in a couple of years. Just remember, when you have presentations or you have something important, you all just presented not only to the entire city council, but the deputy mayor, almost the entire city council staff, and, you know, the ruthless reporter from the Star Tribune. Star Tribune. All in front. I'm kidding. But the Star Tribune. But think about that when you're nervous about your next presentation, because you just, and you all did an amazing job. Yeah. And that says a lot about your composure and your ability. And I know I'm super excited for what the future holds for all four of you. And like Councilmember Jalali said, come back. We need you. Work for the city. I think a couple years ago, the mayor and I presented to the Right Track interns, and I started asking him questions, and we realized he was an intern in PED when he was in high school or college. So it really, to say that you'll be on the city council or mayor, I was an intern in the state house. You know, just know the future is bright for all of you.
Thank you all for your presentations. And just in closing, I was noticing the deputy mayor back there just smiling from ear to ear and thinking, that's your job interview. The first one. It's a big deal. It's a very big deal. And some of us started through the district council. Some of us started through internships at the Capitol. So this is how you get your foot in the door and start climbing up the ladder. So it's really great to hear all of your presentations, and it's been great to work with you. I also want to echo the thanks to the city staff who has supported the Right Track interns. I know we're working on developing even a bigger and bolder plan. All of the ward offices, 2, 3, 6, 5, that had a Right Track intern, our goal is to have 7 Right Track interns at some point in the future. I know that some ward offices that didn't have an intern also stepped up to help with our planning. So I appreciate that, and I just feel like this has been a great posse group that came through. You will probably be connected forever through this experience, and I think that's great. I would be remiss if I didn't give a big shout-out to Jessica Larson-Johnston, who stepped up and really shined in the role of leading this Right Track group. From the perspective of my office, it felt like there was always, like, little kind of meetings and side chats and, like, pep rallies and prepping your presentations today. And for those, I mean, not everyone's probably aware that she lugs steel-toed boots, like, up and down the steps to get them to the right places. And she's really been behind the scenes creating the background for a wonderful experience for the interns as well. So thanks to all of you for stepping up. And thanks to Jessica, who has committed out loud to working with Bryn to really institutionalize a program for Right Track interns so that all 7 of us can, or all 7 offices can find interns next year and can find or create these opportunities for these rising stars in St. Paul. So thank you so, so much to everybody who made this possible and to our interns in particular for your presentations today. Like Mr. Tolbert said, you ripped the Band-Aid off. Big time. Any presentation after this should be just very straightforward, and we're really proud and impressed with your work. Thank you so much. All right, so we have finished fairly close to on time. We do have, because it is our first, it isn't. I will say we have the truck parking ordinance changes should come to us by next week. Hopefully. We decided in lieu of a presentation, we would simply look at the ordinance language and move it forward through our regular legislative process. Are there any updates on boards, commissions, committees, activities, or other from council members before we adjourn or from Ms. House?
Nothing from me.
Nothing from Ms. House? Anything from my colleagues? Mr. Ballinger, you've been quiet. You're okay. I told them, just get in the white water raft and let's go. That's life at the city council. There is nothing else to come before us this morning. We meet several times today, so for now, we will be adjourned.